Welcome. You are about to embark on a unique learning adventure from The Great Courses. Our courses are crafted to be entertaining journeys, both comprehensive and fascinating. They're designed to expand horizons, deepen understanding, and foster epiphanies in a broad array of subjects and university-level disciplines. The lecturers are university professors and subject matter experts carefully selected by The Great Courses and its customers for their intellectual distinction and exceptional abilities to teach. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalogs or visit our website at thegreatcourses.com and imagine how much you can learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the company of some of the greatest minds in the world. These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. These lectures are titled, The Joy of Ancient History. From the mystery cults of Rome to the grandeur of dynastic Egypt, the ancient world continues to provide inspiration, even today. In such fields as politics and philosophy, art, literature, and more, we remained enthralled by stories of Attila the Hun, the drama surrounding Cleopatra, and the genius of Alexander the Great. We're moved by the combination of power and perseverance necessary to build the Great Wall of China and the Pyramid of Giza. In many ways, the ancients laid the foundation for all of Western civilization, which is precisely why the Great Courses has assembled the finest lectures on ancient history from our roster of brilliant professors. Lecture 1. Lessons of the Peloponnesian War. Our first lecture offers a nuanced reflection on war in the ancient Greek world. The Peloponnesian War, which began in 461 BC, dragged on for decades, with devastating consequences for the ancient world. Consider the main literary source on the war, the work of Thucydides, and discover how scholars have viewed later wars in light of the harsh lessons learned by Athens and Sparta. This lecture is from The Peloponnesian War by master historian and award-winning professor Kenneth W. Harrell of Tulane University.
What I wish to do in this lecture is to look at the three related issues on the question of lessons from the Peloponnesian War. The first is the significance of the Peloponnesian War in the wider context of classical Greek history and maybe of classical history in toto, essentially stretching from the time of Homer down to the time of the Emperor Constantine, and why I've made comments to the effect that in teaching Greek history, many historians focus very much on the Peloponnesian War. It is often a centerpiece in lecture courses on the Greek world or ancient civilization in general. The second issue I wish to look at is why do we keep returning to that Peloponnesian War? How has it been studied by the scholarship, by popular writers since the early 19th century? And what lessons have been drawn by these scholars, popular writers, political scientists, philosophers, and the like? And the third point is then to look at the real lessons that we gain by studying it in the way we have studied it in this course, looking very carefully at Thucydides, who's our main literary source and who is in many ways the man who influences our conceptions of the war, as well as the other types of documentary sources I've used. And I think in the final section of this lecture, we can get a very good idea of what lessons Thucydides would like us to draw from the Peloponnesian War. So those are three related issues, and it's something of a tall order. And let me start with the first one, that is the significance of the war in wider classical history. I mentioned in some ways that Thucydides can be censured for overstating the scope of this war. On the one hand, the Peloponnesian War was a very important war in Greek history, but I mentioned at several points that the Peloponnesian War is really the centerpiece of a series of struggles that can be dated from at least 461 BC down to essentially down to 346 BC, to the Peace of Philocrates, where the prime states of Greece, Athens and Sparta, and then Thebes and Corinth and Argos, who were somewhat lesser states, battled for the mastery of Greece, and that the Peloponnesian War is just part of that wider struggle. I also mentioned the fact that the Peloponnesian War was also the war as Thucydides understood it. He participated in the war. He experienced it. He died shortly after 400 BC before he completed his history. And in some ways, the Peloponnesian War is Thucydides' vision of the great war in his lifetime. And so that has to be taken into account. Furthermore, Thucydides, dying around 400 BC, did not live to see the other great war from antiquity that is very well documented, and those are the two related Punic Wars, the First and Second Punic War between Rome and Carthage. Nor did he, of course, know of the great conquest of Alexander the Great. And both of those military adventures or events certainly dwarf the Peloponnesian War on the military side, in the scope of the campaigns of Alexander, in the size of the armies mobilized by Rome and Carthage, and perhaps even in the issues that were at stake in the Punic Wars. In some ways, the Punic Wars are more important than the Peloponnesian War. And yet the Peloponnesian War was very decisive for Greek history, and Thucydides can certainly be given a charitable consideration in the fact that he didn't realize what was to follow after his death. For one, the Peloponnesian War underscored the limitations of the Greek city-state. And that is a point that we have discussed repeatedly in this course. And I mentioned in the last lecture that it is really problematic whether an Athenian victory in 404 BC would have had much of a different impact as, say, a Spartan victory in 404. Because both Sparta and Athens would have encountered many of the same problems. The war had tested and changed their institutions. They had to find new fiscal means to finance war. There was a steady move of turning citizens into taxpayers and hiring mercenaries and professionals. And Athens would have faced the same insoluble problem of how to reconcile her hegemony in a wider political order in the Aegean world, with or without a Spartan partner in that hegemony, with the traditions of the polis. The polis was premised on two very, very powerful emotions and slogans. One was Eleutheria, the concept that every Greek city-state should have its own right to an independent policy. And then the other word that was almost as sacred as Eleutheria was Autonomia. That is autonomy, the right to live under one's own laws. This did not necessarily mean democracy, but it meant the ancestral constitution, the patrias politeia, as they would say in Greek, and the notion of a rule of law, the eunomia, that is a well-ordered state in which all citizens knew what their rights were, in which the laws were respected, and which traditions were followed, and particularly religious conventions, which sanctified all public acts. That very intense notion of citizenship meant that the citizen body was always going to be relatively limited. And the Greeks cannot be faulted because most of humanity has tended to define citizenship as a matter of birth. I repeat again the statement that Herodotus makes. We are Greeks and we are citizens of a polis because we have common altars, that is, we worship the same gods, we have common ancestors or common blood, and common language. And that included in the Greek world dialect, Ionian, Aeolic, or Dorian. And so these very, very intense values of the city-state were extremely difficult to reconcile with the needs for wider security and larger political organization, which increasingly became necessary in the 5th and 4th centuries BC. The Greeks responded quite heroically to the Persian invasion. They were able to settle their differences for a short time and beat back Xerxes. They would not do so well against the Macedonian king, Philip II. Who in many ways was just as much an inimical interloper as the Persian king. He was seen as a barbarian. He was not a product of the polis. He was a king of a kingdom which was semi-Greek by courtesy alone, and most Greeks would have considered the Macedonians not even Greeks but as barbarians. The royal family was sort of given a marginal status as Greeks. And in responding to the Macedonian threat at the in the 4th century BC, the Greeks were not nearly successful. And that is because neither Athens or Sparta had worked out an arrangement whereby the intense loyalties, the political life, the direct participation in assemblies could be somehow reconciled with wider security. Sparta would command her allies in an alliance, and the Spartans were probably much better in consulting their allies and treating them well. But nonetheless, Sparta was the unquestioned hegemon. Sparta found herself in a position after 404 BC, making more demands on those allies than she had ever done before, and that contributed to Spartan unpopularity in the generation after the Peloponnesian War. The Athenians came down very hard on their allies, and their record in dealing with their allies is not a very encouraging one, and one wonders how the Athenians would have handled a victory in the Aegean world after 404 BC. So in some ways, the Peloponnesian War underscored those limitations. Furthermore, the Peloponnesian War transformed institutions in both of the city-states and across the Greek world, and one wonders what the long-term effects of that war were. We don't have sufficient documentation, but the dreary record of wars, treaties, struggles in the two generations of the Peloponnesian War, the changes of, in warfare I've discussed, the changes in political institutions suggest in some ways that the Peloponnesian War really did sap the loyalty, the traditions of sacrifice of many of the cities in the Greeks in the Greek world. Perhaps it's not the kind of sharp class warfare a Marxist historian would point to. But the consensus, the notion of eumenia among various citizens, had taken a severe blow. And the shift of citizens to taxpayers, the hiring increasingly of professional armies, meant that perhaps those Greek city-states were never going to meet a challenge such as Macedon as their ancestors had done against Persia. And that is because of the tremendous sacrifices, economic loss, material loss, the loss of life of the Peloponnesian War. It had been an unusually destructive war. It had been a war as no other. It was quite different from the seasonal wars of the Archaic Age or the great victories won over Xerxes. And as I've mentioned throughout the last half of this course, this war did not conform to the traditions of Greek warfare. Sparta and Athens went into the war with initial strategies. They thought they could win that war very quickly. They were quickly disabused of that. And by 429 BC, they were locked in a tremendously destructive war in which each side tried to destroy the economic basis of the other alliance system and also to psychologically exhaust their opponents. And by 404 BC, I can understand why Athenians would wonder whether they would ever want to vote another war that could result in themselves being cooped up in their city for 10 years under virtual siege and make the types of sacrifices that were expected of them in the final stages of the Peloponnesian War. It's really quite extraordinary that the Athenians didn't break. And the Spartans, too, and their Peloponnesian allies had to make almost as extraordinary sacrifices in launching those fleets. And so in that sense, the Peloponnesian War not only underscored the limitations of the polis, but in some ways broke some of those traditions that made the polis so successful and did help prepare the way for that Macedonian conquest. I also mentioned that a Spartan or Athenian victory, in a sense, then did not have the same type of decisive impact in the course of Greek history. And throughout this course, I've stressed that Sparta and Athens were much more alike than unalike, and that an Athenian victory may not have changed very much the cultural achievements and direction of Greek civilization as a Spartan victory. And for a moment, I think I would like to stress that point by comparing that other war from antiquity that is very well documented, and those are the Punic Wars. The Punic Wars fought between 264 and 241 BC, and 218 and 201 BC, that is the First and Second Punic Wars, it pitted the polities of Rome and Carthage. Now, neither of these states were a city-state by any Greek definition. They were far more powerful states. And in a way, the stakes were much higher in the Punic Wars, particularly in terms of Western civilization. Rome had the organizational genius and eventually learned to appreciate its Greek cultural debt. So a Roman victory had a decisive impact on the course of Western civilization, far more than a Spartan or Athenian victory would have done in the Peloponnesian War. You're still dealing in the Peloponnesian War with basically Greek city-states with the same religious conventions, assumptions, and aesthetic values. In the case of the Second Punic War, Rome showed an ability to organize fleets and armies on a scale unimagined in the Greek world. And in part, this underscored, too, the political institutions of Rome, and her unique notion of citizenship. In Rome, citizenship was not a birthright. It was not something that was dictated simply by birth. Rome, very early on, in contrast to the Greek city-states, learned that citizenship was a group of political and legal rights, that it could be handed out to loyal allies who could be promoted into various categories. Categories in many ways that the Spartans had, but the Spartans never extended the franchise anything like the Order of Rome. And so at the time of the outbreak of the Second Punic War, Rome had over 1 million citizens and allies eligible for military service. This is extraordinary. This is probably equal to about half the population of the Greek world in 431 BC. And the Romans could call upon sacrifices from these citizens and allies that were beyond anything the Greek states could imagine. In the opening stages of the Second Punic War, the Romans lost at least 100,000 battle deaths. In campaigns against Hannibal, and yet the Romans continued to battle the Carthaginian general, and by the conservative count, in 212 BC, the Romans had 280,000 men under arms and a fleet of over 70,000 men. These are extraordinary figures. But those successes in Rome underscored a different type of citizenship, a citizenship to which we are heirs. That is, anyone can become a Roman citizen if they are proved loyal. It is a matter of political rights. It's a matter of thinking Roman rather than being born a Roman. And that was the organizational genius of Rome. And the success of Rome meant that this was a concept to be transmitted to the Western tradition. So in many ways, the Punic War is a more important war in the overall scheme of Western civilization. It is certainly an inspiring one. We have accounts by Livy and Polybius in which the Roman people respond to the sacrifices in some ways very much like the Athenians and Spartans. And the Roman Senate is always is depicted as judicious leadership, collective aristocratic leadership, something that the Spartans would appreciate. And yet it is the Peloponnesian War to which we return. And it is the Peloponnesian War that many scholars have turned to in recent years to find some sort of understanding or lessons in confronting the crises of the Cold War and now the current war against fundamentalists in Islam. And there are two reasons for this. One is that we have in the Peloponnesian War an extraordinary historian, Thucydides, a man who has a level of accuracy and a level of insight and a level of eloquence that is not matched by Livy or by Polybius or any other author. Thucydides sets a standard of history, but he also sets a standard of historical analysis. And I always think when I read Livy that I'm inspired. But when I'm reading Thucydides, I'm forced to reflect, I'm forced to analyze, I'm forced to think. And I'm forced to think on what the consequences and lessons are of the Peloponnesian War. And as I mentioned, this is the first war recorded in which we find citizens who would ultimately have their destinies in their own hands, voting a war, enduring a war, waging a war, and living with the consequences of that war. And these lessons still resonate with us today. And they have resonated also, and this is the second reason we study the Peloponnesian War, they have resonated with writers since the 19th century, the early 19th century, who have looked at the Peloponnesian War for those lessons and have tried to draw some sort of conclusions from the Peloponnesian War, starting with George Grote. That famous History of Greece, published posthumously in eight volumes in 1874, in which Grote saw the struggle between Athens and Sparta as essentially the struggle between Great Britain and revolutionary and Napoleonic France. And again, there's always the danger in looking for these lessons of seeing one's own reflection in the images of the Athenians and the Spartans. And Grote really fixed our attention on the Athenians. From the Athenians, Grote drew important lessons. That Athens was a commercial empire based on seaborne trade. That Athens was somehow progressive, that Athens promoted initiative and imagination, that Athens was in many ways the school of Greece, as Pericles would like to say, and therefore dictated many of the aesthetic reflexes and literary genres of the Western tradition. And furthermore, Athens provided models of leadership and also mistakes to avoid in one of these great conflicts where the citizens have to choose their own destinies. And Athens comes off as, in many ways, the model to study, both for inspiration, both for lessons, and also both for warnings of mistakes to avoid. To Grote's credit, Sparta does come off as conservative and is often implied, there's an implied comparison to revolutionary Napoleonic France, but Sparta does come off as something of a noble foe. However, in the later traditions, starting with the First World War, with the writings of Arnold Toynbee, in analogies drawn during the Second World War, and particularly in the writings of scholars in the Cold War period, from 1945 to 1991, these perceptions were changed, sharpened, and reshaped, again, to meet the challenges of the existing world. And one theme that always comes through in this history is every generation has to write its own history. In these interpretations, Athens, again, is hailed as the model of Western democratic societies, as the first participatory democracy, even though they held slaves and women didn't have active citizen rights. Nonetheless, there is a tendency to see in Athens ourselves. And here, the Athenians very much become ourselves. There has also been a tendency in this scholarship of the Cold War, the Cold War period and the post-Cold War period, to credit the Athenians with diplomatic aims, with notions and ideals of a nation state, essentially a modern concept. I've repeatedly stressed that the Athenians did not have this type of outlook. that in many ways they were dictated by the same kinds of social and religious conventions as their opponents, the Spartans and the Peloponnesians, and that the notion of a realpolitik, as Bismarck would put it, and the kinds of institutions a modern society would have, a modern state, to pursue diplomatic aims were just not available to Athens or Sparta. And I've qualified this image that's come out of the Cold War period, where Athens in many ways is upheld as essentially the model for the United States in its confrontation of this, with the Soviet Union. Furthermore, in the scholarship of that period, Sparta suffers a considerable loss of prestige in the eyes of many historians and popular writers. Increasingly, Sparta is treated as a repressive and oppressive society, some would even say totalitarian. The images drawn between Sparta and totalitarian regimes of the 20th century are not flattering, and the dichotomy of Spartan citizen and Helot is drawn very sharply, and this has spawned all of the scholarship, the Marxist analysis of Sparta as a society to avoid. That Sparta blew it back in the 7th century BC, that the Spartans lucked out in winning the Peloponnesian War, and there really isn't much to learn from Sparta, except don't construct a society along those lines. It's unimaginative, it's conservative, it's repressive. The final conclusion to this type of scholarship is in the recent work published by Victor Hansen, A War Like No Other. And that phrase comes from Thucydides himself. It is Thucydides' proclamation of why he studied the Peloponnesian War, why he sat down to write this history. And in Hansen's work, Athens comes off very much as the progressive progenitor of Western democracies today, and Sparta comes off as not only conservative and repressive, but as alien, as virtually not a member of the Western tradition. And that is a position that is really overdrawn. And in trying to put this war into the contexts of the ideological conflicts of the 19th and 20th century, in seeing Sparta and Athens as essentially proto-nation states, there's a tendency to overdraw the differences between the Spartans and Athenians, and also to distort the reasons for the Peloponnesian War and the lessons that can be learned from the Peloponnesian War. And it's all too facile to look at this war and draw conclusions that we would like to draw rather than to look at the record itself and see what it tells us. And this then brings us back to that third point I mentioned at the start of this lecture. Then what are the lessons to be drawn from the Peloponnesian War? What would be the lessons that Thucydides would wish us to draw? Well, here I think there are several important points that come out and lessons that can be drawn by generation after generation, because as Thucydides says himself at several points in his history, that human nature and human character, being what it is, will have cause to look at the events of the Peloponnesian War, to draw lessons, and these lessons are not moralizing and philosophical lessons, but lessons of what war does to a society, particularly what does war do to leaders and citizens of democracies or governments in which the citizens determine their own destinies. This is what underscores Thucydides' analysis. And here he makes some very telling lessons. Gives us some very telling lessons, some of these to be drawn directly from his words, and others to be surmised. First and foremost, I think Thucydides saw leadership in these governments is all important. It was leadership that made the difference in both the Persian and Peloponnesian Wars, in Thucydides' opinion. And he gives us two models of leadership in his account of the Peloponnesian War, which really stand as examples of what leaders in some kind of democracy or republic or representative government should follow. First and foremost is the leadership of Pericles. This is laid out very clearly in Book 2, Chapter 65, in which he tells us that Pericles had the ability to inspire the Athenians to make sacrifices, do what was necessary to maintain their democracy, uphold their imperial traditions, and keep their integrity vis-a-vis the Spartans when they were in despair. But when the Athenians became too anxious, when they became too arrogant, when hubris, as a Greek tragedian would say, set in, Pericles then knew instinctively how to calm that assembly and bring it back to a reality. And that analysis of Pericles is really all important. We can debate the wisdom of Pericles' strategy in 431 BC or whether he should have passed the Megarian decree. But no one can dispute that the way Pericles led the assembly, the way he articulated what the benefits of democracy were and what sacrifices were necessary to maintain that democracy, Pericles was exceptional. And after 429 BC, no leader in Athens came close to him. And that is clear from the record. Thucydides doesn't have to do any kind of moralizing on that point. He also gives us an image of Themistocles, the man who is the architect for the victory over Xerxes. And many of those same qualities are in Themistocles, but Themistocles also had a remarkable quality that proved essential on the battlefield: his ability to mass information quickly, come up with a snap decision, and carry that action with resolution. That was the type of genius that delivered the victory at Salamis. And that is another quality that is necessary in a great leader. And those types of qualities can be compared to other great leaders in democratic and republican constitutions. One thinks of William Pitt the Younger, the great commoner in the Seven Years' War, Abraham Lincoln, or Winston Churchill in the Second World War, just to name several. The second important point about leadership is where leadership can go wrong. And in the later stages of the Peloponnesian War, the best the Athenians got was Alcibiades teaming up with Thrasybulus and Theramenes. Theramenes, a rather unsavory figure who dominated the assembly, eventually died protesting the 30 and actually rehabilitated his reputation. And Thrasybulus was essentially a military tactician. And Alcibiades, in many ways, was Pericles in reverse. And Alcibiades did not conform to Thucydides' standard of leadership. If anything, Alcibiades did himself in by exaggerating his role and by not restraining the assembly. And his final self-exile in 406 BC and his miserable death, probably at the hands of a hit squad sent out by the 30 tyrants or Sparta, was testimony to his failed leadership in many ways. And for all of Alcibiades' creativity and genius, he did not have the interest of Athens at heart, and ultimately he aspired to the role of a tyrant. The Spartans, in terms of leadership, do rather well. There are no charismatic kings, but the Spartan military tradition produces officers such as Brasidas, Gylippus, and even Lysander, who managed to soldier on and win that victory, backed by the kings, the Gerasia and Ephors. And very often Spartan leadership is underestimated, particularly King Archidamus, who was the Eurypontid king who had grave doubts about going into this war in 432 BC. And in some ways, Spartan leadership and Spartan institutions of leadership hold up very well in the Peloponnesian War. A second point that comes out besides leadership is how war changes institutions, political institutions, economic institutions of warfare. And we've spent a good deal of time, especially in the first half of this course, explaining these types of changes, the changes in Greek warfare, changes in fiscal institutions. And here there are a number of changes that come through. Thucydides does not talk about them as directly, and we've drawn on documentary sources and other accounts to stress this. But just think of how the Athenians had to adjust their democracy, especially in the final stages of the Peloponnesian War. The institution of the proboloi, the restrictions put on the democracy at points. These were efforts by the Athenians to reconcile their democracy with the needs of strategy to wage a great war. And the Athenians held up very well to this. Twice the Athenians avoided civil war, particularly in 411 BC, the types of stasis that would tear apart a city, destroy eumenia, and pit the lower and upper classes against each other. Fiscal institutions were changed. New methods of warfare, the hiring of professional soldiers and mercenaries. All of these institutions were radically transformed by the Peloponnesian War. To be sure, these changes can be traced back earlier in the 5th century BC. But the Peloponnesian War changes the political, economic, fiscal, and military institutions of the classical Greek world and gives us a different world, a Greek city-state, which in the 4th century BC fails to meet the Macedonian challenge. And finally, I think the most telling aspects of the changes that war will wreak is with the citizens themselves. Repeatedly, Thucydides tells us the mixed images. There are depressing and dark images that come through this these accounts. For one, the Athenian assembly increasingly loses its ability to make rational decisions without the leadership of Pericles. And after 429 BC, Thucydides marks this in a series of matched debates over Mytilene, over the question of the fate of Milos, over the Sicilian expedition. And the Athenians don't hold up very well in these discussions. The Athenians are driven by war to great expediency to survive. And they take the harshest measures in dealing with prisoners. And this doesn't mean that the Athenians were breaking the Geneva Convention's rules. There were always harsh rules in war. But by 404 BC, many Peloponnesians felt that Athens merited destruction, the enslavement of its population, the execution of its male citizens. And only the Spartans restrained the Peloponnesians for doing this. Part of it was out of pragmatism, but the Spartans also said that Athens got a pass on this for opposing the Persians, and they were probably sincere about that fact. That alone spared the Athenians the type of destruction they had meted out to many of their rebellious allies. And one can study the increasing savagery of the war in the way prisoners are treated. The Athenians, for instance, in the later stages, cut off the thumbs of sailors who had deserted over to the Spartan side so they could not row in the future. And the Spartans executed large numbers of Athenians at Syracuse and then after the Battle of Aegospotami. And so the increasing savagery of the war reflects how the war changes the attitude of citizens and how the assemblies demand reprisals and demand a higher victory and demand some kind of compensation for the horrid sacrifice they've endured. And yet for all of these dark images that come through that are chilling and remind us how war is a harsh teacher, particularly the images that come through in the Civil War of Corcyra, where citizens are pitted against each other, where the traditions of eunomia are destroyed, where the consensus where citizens can rule together under a constitution, and there is a loyal opposition, and all these notions can be destroyed so rapidly in a war, these dark images are also offset by some remarkably noble images in this very mixed picture of how citizens can respond to that sacrifice. The funeral oration of Pericles, which was probably delivered in 431 BC, is perhaps one of the great noble expressions of what a sacrifice means for citizens. It stands on par with the Gettysburg Address. And both of those documents still move me to tears when I read them. The Athenians responded with remarkable resilience and courage in waging the later stages of the Peloponnesian War. The disaster in Sicily should have finished the Athenians. And yet from 411 to 405 BC, the Athenians mounted a remarkable recovery. And if one counts the number of ships sunk and wrecked, down to 405 BC, the Athenians are winning 3-1 over the Peloponnesians due to the great victories won by Alcibiades and Thrasybulus. And yet the Spartans were just as noble. And the Spartans and the Peloponnesians also heard the call from their cities, and the Spartans repeatedly made efforts to launch those fleets. And as I mentioned, the Spartans had to win that war, and their institutions proved very effective in winning that war, particularly their traditions of the officer corps, their constitutional kings that gave unity to a coalition alliance. And many lessons can be drawn from Spartan society, as I have argued repeatedly in this course. And so perhaps the greatest point that comes through in Thucydides' lessons is how citizens respond to the war. And even more important than whether Athens or Sparta won the war was how the Spartans and Athenians and the Peloponnesian allies held up to the demands of war. And all of those states did remarkably well considering the length of the war and the destruction of the war, and would that we could handle such a crisis as well as they did. And in the final analysis, that is what is most important that comes from Thucydides. That is the citizens themselves, their leaders, their institutions, which held up to the hard test of war. And this is what Thucydides wishes us to look at and to draw our lessons from. And it is based on these notions that we should read his Peloponnesian War, a war and an account which Thucydides said, in his own words, preserves for future generations a possession for all time. To katema eis ae.
Lecture 2, Parthenon and Acropolis. On a rocky outcrop above the venerable city of Athens is the Acropolis, where you'll find an array of temples, including the goddess Athena's sanctuary. Although time and wars ravaged the original structures during the mid-5th century BC, Pericles began a vigorous building project to resurrect these sacred grounds. In this lecture, you'll enter the Acropolis through the extravagant Propylaea, or gatehouse, with its imposing Doric columns. Then you'll stroll through the rebuilt Parthenon, the exquisite temple renowned for its sculptures, friezes, and architectural refinements. This lecture is from The Age of Pericles by Dr. Jeremy McInerney, the Davidson Kennedy Associate Professor of Classical Studies at the University of Pennsylvania.
there is a whole other aspect of the life of Athens and the Athenians that I want to turn to now to complement what we've been doing in the other lectures, and that is to bring our attention to the Acropolis. We began with the Agora, looking at the downtown where the daily life of the Athenians proceeded, where their politics occurred and their legal activities and their commercial activities. But if you've ever been to Athens, and I hope you will go there if you haven't, you cannot help be struck by the fact that looming over the ancient city is a massive outcrop of rock, the Acropolis. And it is up on that rock, the heights above Athens, that the Athenians, in the generation of Pericles, transformed an area that had had dozens of different sanctuaries into one coherent whole. So, in a way, what we're going to see on the Acropolis in the time of Pericles is a similar kind of process to the transformation of the Agora, where we saw progressively the space being articulated as the heart of the democracy. Well, if that's the heart of the democracy, then the Acropolis is the religious soul of the democracy. And so we want to talk about how that took shape in the particular way that it did. Long before Pericles, long before Athens had any kind of renown, there was a palace up on top of the Acropolis, and I'm referring to the Bronze Age, so a period of at least 500 or 600 years earlier than Pericles. If you have ever been to a place like Mycenae or to Tiryns, you will have seen two of the great Bronze Age palaces that the Greeks built in their early history. And something like that, we don't know exactly its size and shape because most of the later traces of it were wiped out, but something like that must have existed up on the Acropolis. And it's interesting that in many parts of the Greek world, there is a transformation that takes place where there are Bronze Age palaces after the Bronze Age and with the collapse of Mycenaean and Minoan society. Many of these places will remain as a ruin, but as a dramatic reminder of the power of that region, and will then be rebuilt in subsequent centuries. And I'm talking now often a space of 200 or 300 years passing. They will be rebuilt, but they will be reborn as religious sanctuaries, palaces that were first occupied by kings will come back to life as temples occupied by gods. And that, for example, is exactly what takes place in Athens. So we have to wonder whether there wasn't some memory, some recollection of an earlier time of glory in Athens' history when there was perhaps some great king, the equivalent in status of Agamemnon or Menelaus, living up there on the Acropolis. However, like the rest of the Mycenaean world, those traces were largely wiped out. There are a few little bits and pieces left up there. We know that there were some mud bricks also up there, and some graves and stone foundations have also been found dating to the Bronze Age up on the Acropolis. But after the collapse of Bronze Age civilization and then the transformation of the Greek world in the 8th and the 7th and the 6th centuries, then new cults were founded and established up there. In particular, it was associated with Athena, the tutelary goddess, the deity who took care of Athens and for whom the city was named. Interestingly, although there will be a succession of temples to Athena up on the Acropolis, it was an olive tree that somehow encapsulated the relationship between Athens and Athena. The olive tree was a gift that had been given to the Athenians. And the particular olive tree that grew up on the Acropolis was regarded as sacred, as Athena's gift. It was believed that Poseidon and Athena had once competed for control of the land of Athens, and that Poseidon, rather foolishly, had only offered the Athenians a pool of water, but since he's the god of the sea, it was salt water and of no use to the Athenians. There was a pool of brackish water up on the Acropolis, and Athenians could point to this and say, look, this is what the god Poseidon gave us. But there is the olive tree. And that tree growing up on the Acropolis was regarded as a tangible proof that Athens was the city of Athena, that there was a contractual relationship, if you like, between the Athenians and their goddess. She was not, however, the only goddess worshipped up on the Acropolis. There were other gods who received cult up there, such as Zeus, the father of gods and men, who was remembered as Zeus who descends in the lightning bolt. And again, up on the Acropolis, Athenians could point to a mark in the rock and say, that is where the lightning bolt struck. That was Zeus coming down to earth. So it became, as it were, a three-dimensional outdoor museum that had these living, breathing evidences of the relationship between the gods and the men of earlier days. And that's what made the whole of the Acropolis sacred. That's what made it sacred territory, a sanctuary to the gods. In addition, there was Hephaestus, the smithy god who was worshipped up there, and Artemis also received cult honours up on the Acropolis in a city version of a cult that also met about 25 miles east of the city. And this pairing of a city cult with a country cult, again, is a very regular feature of Greek religion. So in that respect, the Acropolis of Athens was not unexpected or not unusual. There were, however, a number of lesser heroes and heroines who you'll hear very little about. The best way to get this information is to read Pausanias's description of Athens. And you will find, if you read a description of the ancient Acropolis, that there were all sorts of minor gods and heroes who we very rarely hear about otherwise. So, for example, Erechtheus, who was supposedly the first king of Athens, was honoured up on the Acropolis, as was another early king, Cecrops, who may have appeared in the form of a snake-bodied god, and the virgin daughters of Cecrops, whose names were Pandrosus, Aglaurus, and Herse. And really, these cults were not widespread throughout the Greek world. These are not pan-Hellenic deities. These are very local cults venerated in Athens, but all located up on the Acropolis. Now, it's interesting, if we were to compare the Acropolis in Athens with some of the other well-known shrines, such as that of Delphi or of Delos or of Olympia, many shrines which became pan-Hellenic, that is to say, were universally venerated by all the Greeks, we'll find that in most of those sanctuaries, there is only one god, or maybe a second god, a consort, who will be worshipped. At Delphi, Apollo, and occasionally Dionysus. At Delos, Apollo and his sister Artemis, and their mother Leto. At Olympia, primarily Zeus, and also his wife and consort Hera. But it's really only up on the Acropolis of Athens that you have this absolute plethora of cults to various gods and goddesses, some well-known and others hardly known at all outside of Athens. So it's a brimming, teeming sanctuary above the city. By the time of the Persian Wars, which is where we began our survey in this series, the Acropolis housed most of the important cults of the Athenian state. And I make that qualification because I want people to be clear that, of course, people had gods and goddesses in their own houses. They worshipped the spirits of their ancestors and they would have small shrines to Heracles or any other god or goddess. But the Acropolis was really serving now as the center for the religious life of the entire city of Athens, the entire community. On the northern side of the Acropolis, which is to say the side that looks down over the Agora, there was a succession of temples occupying a space where today we can still see foundations that go back to the 6th century. This is sometimes referred to by scholars as the Old Athena Temple, and you'll also see it referred to in the literature as the Derpfeld Foundations. It was excavated by Derpfeld, Schliemann's associate, in the 19th century. To the south, which is to say away from the Agora side of the Acropolis, there was a succession of even larger temples that would be built. The current Parthenon, which occupies that side, the south side of the Acropolis, is in fact the third temple to occupy that spot. And we hear before that of an earlier temple. The first one there was probably the Hecatompedon, which means a 100-foot-long temple. And then after that, late in the 6th century, the Athenians began work on a temple which is sometimes called the Pre-Parthenon because it's the one from before the Parthenon. That temple was in the process of being built when the Persians sacked Athens. So That's an interesting point that I want to raise, because people often ask, well, why isn't more restoration work done? Why don't we rebuild these temples? And the question that I think a professional archaeologist would sometimes pose is, which phase are you going to rebuild? Because that was a living site that experienced hundreds of years of architectural and archaeological change. So the Parthenon that we see, and which is a glorious building, wasn't even there at the beginning of Athens' golden age under the Persians. Its predecessor was there, and it was only half built when the Persians sacked the city. The Athenians actually kept some of the broken bits of that old temple. And if you're standing now in the Agora of Athens, or if you're standing even in the Plaka, and you look up towards the Acropolis from the northern side, you can still see bits of the old temple built into the walls up there. Now, that's actually an interesting point, and I don't bring that up merely as an antiquarian detail. The reason why those bits and pieces are still there is because the Greeks took an oath in 479, following the liberation of Athens, that they would not rebuild the temples that had been destroyed. So for a generation after the Persian Wars, and remember, this is the period we've been talking about where Athenian power is growing, where they're driving the Persians out of the Aegean, and where they're establishing their own authority and bringing many other Greeks into their empire. At the same time, if you'd gone up to the Acropolis, you would have still seen dramatic vestiges of the Persian sack, because they didn't rebuild the city. There would have been a burnt-out shell of a Parthenon, and the bits that had fallen down and were rolling around were still considered sacred. You didn't just dump them over the side, but you rebuilt them into the walls of the Acropolis, because somehow they were venerable as well. So for a good generation, there was probably very little change that took place up on the Acropolis. The major change appears to have taken place under Cimon, who extended the fortification walls that lie on the southern side of the Acropolis. On the northern side, the walls of the Acropolis are right on bedrock. On the southern side, if you look up on the southern side of the Acropolis, you'll see massive retaining walls that run up for many, many feet, because they built this wall away from the bedrock and then filled in the space in between as a retaining wall so that they would have a platform to build on. Some scholars also believe that Cimon rebuilt the Propylaea, the monumental entrance gate at the western side of the Acropolis. So it seems that even before Pericles, there may have been a notion in Athens that if you were the big man, if you were the leading politician of the day, you should express that power in a building program. And in the case of Cimon, we've got the wall, possibly the Propylaea, and certainly the building of the Telesterion, the Hall of Mysteries at Eleusis. And you can think, really, of things like the programs of recent French presidents, of Mitterrand putting a pyramid into the middle of the courtyard of the Louvre, or Georges Pompidou putting in that hideous monstrosity that passes for a museum in Paris with his name on it, the Centre Pompidou. So Athenian politicians also had this notion that you do big building programs. It was Pericles, however, and here we get a wonderful joining of the story of the individual with the story of the society. It was Pericles who, in the middle of the 5th century, after the death of Cimon, initiated an astonishingly vigorous and ambitious building program. You remember that we talked earlier about the Athenians suffering disaster in Egypt and there being disaffections and revolts from the Athenian Empire, and you'll recall that I mentioned that around that time the Athenians moved the treasury of the Delian League back to Athens. Well, putting down revolts, advertising to the Greek world that the Athenians were still the most powerful state in the Aegean, and claiming the Delian treasury for their own, gave the Athenians an opportunity now to use a great deal of money from the allies in a most ambitious building program. And this program would come to advertise and to demonstrate the power of Athens. So when you look at the Acropolis, you must look at it schizophrenically. You must look at it as a religious sanctuary and as a statement of the power of Imperial Athens at the same time. Let's go through the buildings of the Periclean building program. The first of these, of course, that we have to deal with is the Parthenon itself. This was the first building in the new program. They began construction around 447, so less than a decade after the Delian League treasury was moved to Athens. And the building was completed in an astonishing 9 years, between 447 and 438. The dimensions of the Parthenon, measured by its columns along the long side and the short side, are 17 by 8. 17 on the long side and 8 on the short side. And as any architect will tell you, that means that it is not like an archaic temple, which tended to be much more than twice as long as it was narrow. So it was very much an advertisement of the latest style in the 5th century when it was built, and is rightly regarded as one of the masterpieces of Western architecture. It's remarkable for a couple of quite famous architectural refinements, which we should mention. First of all, if you stand at the level upon which the columns sit, the so-called stylobate, the floor, if you like, of the Parthenon, and if you look along the length of the building, you'll notice that that level actually curves slightly. And the effect of this is to make the building seem lighter. Instead of it being anchored to the rock, it seems to be lifting off the rock. Quite an accomplishment for a building made of limestone and marble. And similarly, if you look carefully at the columns, and if you look side on to the columns, you'll notice as you look along the columns of the Parthenon that they actually bend somewhat, that they're not a true line, but rather are moulded. And the reason for this is that it gives the columns a feeling of plasticity, of flexibility. The effect is of a building which, though made of stone, is somehow light and almost alive. Now, I emphasize those features because, in some respects, Greek architecture is astonishingly simple. And this is a point that many scholars, I think, probably would disagree with me on. But I want to make the case that to build a Greek temple, you don't need much. You end up having a level course, either of bedrock or stone laid over bedrock, to make sure that you've got a flat surface that's uniformly flat to build on. You put three steps on that, and the platform at the top of the third step is the platform upon which the entire building will rest. That's the stylobate. The building itself is simply a large rectangular building with solid walls and three rooms. The front room, which is the vestibule leading in, the main room, which is the cellar, in which there will be a statue, and a back room, which is often a treasury room. And around the entire interior, on the outer edges, both long and short sides, will be columns. Now, it doesn't take a great deal to do that. And then on top, of course, you have a pitched roof with pedimental sculpture in the triangular front and back, and then various forms of relief sculpture along the sides. Now, I emphasize this simplicity because I'd like to suggest that the genius of the architecture on the Acropolis, particularly of the Parthenon, is that it takes this set formula of Greek architecture and by some very simple additions and modifications, it perfects it. But it works within the formula. There are many, many temples leading up to the Parthenon. It's just in some ways the best of the lot. There are, however, some ways in which the Parthenon is really anomalous. It breaks some of the regular rules that you expect of Greek temples. The porches at the front and at the back are both quite shallow. You approach the Parthenon from the west, which is, in fact, its backside. If you've ever seen any of these famous shots, the scene that you see as you walk through the gateway, the propylaea, and you first see that three-quarter profile view of the Parthenon, that's actually the back end of the building. And so you walk all along the length of one of its long sides in order to get round to the east porch, which is the proper entrance to the building. The layout of the interior is also odd because the building is both a shrine to the cult of Athena, but it's also a massive treasure chamber, and we have inventories of the goods that were found within, or that were stored, within the Parthenon, and we know of quite literally hundreds and thousands of objects made of gold and silver and other precious metals and ivory and precious woods. And yet, the two interior rooms of the Parthenon don't communicate with each other. They're quite separate. The crowning glory of the Parthenon is, of course, its decoration, particularly, well, its pedimental sculpture, yes, but also its metopes and friezes. The metopes are the frieze that run around the outside of the building, and they show scenes of Greeks fighting traditional enemies such as drunken Lapiths and Amazons and Trojans. And this is a common feature of Greek temple art, that you'll have some sort of combat scene. And this is meant, I think, to suggest, I'm not the first to say this, that it represents the victory of order over chaos and of Greek over Persian. So life for the Greeks is a contest. It's an agon, a conflict. And their temples put these conflicts on the outside so that you can be reassured that, yes, the gods will win. They'll beat the giants and the titans. Yes, the Greeks will win. We'll beat the Persians. The west pediment showed the victory of Athena over Poseidon for the control of Athens. That's what you would have seen as you walked up onto the Acropolis. But then round on the eastern side, there was another pediment that probably showed the birth of Athena, though there's a good deal of debate about what's depicted up there. And the frieze, the continuous frieze that ran around the top of the interior colonnade, depicted a procession. And most scholars interpret this as the Pan-Athenaic procession, the great religious procession that crossed the city of Athens and came up to the Acropolis. So think about that for a moment. It suggests that if you were in the Pan-Athenaic procession, if you were going up to the Acropolis to worship Athena along with every other man and woman in Athens, when you got up to the supreme building up there, her temple, what you saw was that very procession up there in the sculpture. It's a confident city-state that can advertise itself that way and can say to every other Greek who comes up there, look at what we've accomplished, look what we've got. The second building of the Periclean building program that we should comment on is the Propylaia, which simply means the gatehouse or the gateway to the Acropolis, the building located on the western side of the Acropolis through which you must pass. It is the only major entrance up onto the rock of the Acropolis. And it attracted a great deal of attention in antiquity, even more than the Parthenon. The Parthenon was viewed as a temple. It was understood to be a temple, and so you could justify to some extent the extravagance of spending money on it. But the Propylaia is a gateway, just a glorified entrance. And so the fact that the Athenians spent so much money on it excited a great deal of comment at the time and controversy. It was designed by an architect named Menisocles. It covered the entire western portion of the Acropolis rock, and like the Parthenon, it was built rapidly, taking only 5 years, from 437 to 432 BC. Now, there are a couple of tricks here that are worth paying attention to in the building of the Propylaia. In the first case, the exterior columns that you see as you're coming up are made of the Doric order. The Doric order is the one that is approximately 6 times taller than it is wide at its base. So it's stocky. The Greeks think of it as being a masculine order. And on the top of a Doric column, the entablature will sit on what just looks like a flat pillow at the top of the column. But after you've come up and you go through the huge staircase, you're in a passageway inside the Propylaia where the columns are 6 Ionic columns. And Ionic columns have a different proportion. Instead of being 6 to 1, height to breadth, they're 8 to 1. So they look more narrow and more slender. And they have flutes cut into them. The Greeks would say, looking like the drapery of a woman's dress. And if you look at the entablature that sits on top of an Ionic column, instead of there being a flat pillow at the top of the column, there will be 2 volutes that, as Vitruvius would say, look like the curls of a woman's hairdo. So the Doric columns on the outside are meant to look manly and imposing. But once you move into the building and you're passing through to the Acropolis, you want something a little lighter, a little less oppressive. And for that, they use slender Ionic columns. So the interior of the gate complex appears actually less massive and lighter when you're inside it than it does as you're coming up from the outside. Now, this mixing of the orders of Doric and Ionic is characteristic of the Parthenon as well. And so what happens is that you have a lovely visual harmony. Whether you're aware of it or not doesn't matter. It's a trick being played by the architects and the designers. So that as you come up and pass through the doorway, you're seeing in the Parthenon a building that imitates this mixing of different styles. The Propylaia did not carry sculptures or reliefs, and so it was not famous for these in antiquity, but it did have a marble ceiling that was decorated with golden stars set into a blue backdrop. And so it would have been quite a stunning effect as you walked through, and as you came from the light outside into the darker interior and looked up, there would have been these gold stars twinkling at you before you then passed through again onto the Acropolis itself. A dramatic entrance that sets you up for the experience of going onto the Acropolis. Flanking this impressive entrance, there were two wings. The one on the south side gave access to a terrace on which there sat a very small temple that was dedicated to Athena Nike, the goddess of victory. And on the northern side, there was another wing that housed in it a pinakotheke, or a picture gallery. The third of the buildings that really acquire their final shape as a result of the Periclean building program, and in some ways the most peculiar building in all of Greek architecture, is the Erechtheion. Now, the Erechtheion takes its name from Erechtheus, the first king of Athens, and its primary cult was the cult of that king, Erechtheus, but it really housed a number of different cults, separate cults. And what was happening, I think, under Pericles was that the architects of the Acropolis were trying to create buildings that would harmonize and bring all the cults together into a single unitary complex. So there was a cult of Poseidon in this building, there was a cult of Zeus, there was a cult of Athena, a cult of Erechtheus, but you would hardly know that from the exterior of the building, although it is certainly an odd building to look at. One of the reasons why I think the Erechtheion is very important to take note of is that it was here that was located the most venerable cult of Athena. Now, you may well have heard of the statue of Athena built by Phidias, friend of Pericles, that it was made of gold and ivory, and that it dominated the interior of the Parthenon. Look, if you'd walked into the Parthenon, there would have been this statue much bigger than life size, looming in the darkness, surrounded by gold and silver. It was impressive. But that's not the statue you went to when you wanted to venerate the goddess, when you wanted to ask for her intercession and to ask for her help. For that, you went to the old temple, the Erechtheion, and in there was a piece of olive wood. Just a piece of wood. But the Athenians believed that it had dropped from heaven, and that it was sacred because Athena had sent it to them. So there was an object from heaven that had the quality of sacredness that they associated with their goddess, and that's where you went to pray to Athena. So it's really quite wonderful because the Acropolis ends up having these huge buildings that are impressive as imperial artistic masterpieces advertising the power of Athens, and then there is also a shrine that you would go to pray to the goddess in your own personal devotions. As I've mentioned, Zeus here was believed to descend in a lightning bolt, and in the porch where that lightning bolt left its mark on the ground, they left a hole in the coffer of the ceiling so that you could look up and say, that's the spot. It came down through there to that mark on the ground. So there was an interactive quality, I think, to going up to the Acropolis and experiencing the gods up there. Perhaps the most remarkable aspect of the Erechtheion is that if you're on the western side of the building, you'll find that there is a huge lintel, a block of stone that seems to be sitting stranded in the middle of a wall with a great gap underneath it. And the best suggestion that's been made is that when they built this wall, they actually built it in such a way that it was built over a pre-existing thing there, namely the tree of Athena. And it was because there was a tree growing in the ground right there that as they built the Erechtheion, they had to honour that space and build around and over it with a huge lintel to support the weight of the wall above. If that is true, then we really have to use our imaginations as we look at the Acropolis. Because what we're seeing is a curious blend. We are seeing the power of Athens on display. Imagine all those allies coming with their panoply of armor and their cows to venerate Athena and to recognize the power of Athens, the empire of Athens. But it was complemented by the real devotional belief of ordinary, humble Athenians.